The following program, Building a Democracy Movement in an Age of Austerity and Corporatization, was sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on April 30, 2011. The featured speaker, Ben Mansky, is Executive Director of the Liberty Tree Foundation and co-founder of Wisconsin Wave.
Okay.
My name is Thomas Kozlowski. My question is regarding the courts. It seems to me we have seen the courts, not only the courts in the state, but on national level, federal, go against any attempt at all to protect the people who are protesting these unjust laws. And my question is, at the Supreme Court level, we know there's at least six Catholic justices, and we, as well as corporate justices, I mean, they're corporate justices. And until it seems to me we have a change of how those people are either are elected or changed to elect them rather than appointed, there's not going to be change. And of course, that goes down through the system. I think you're aware of the, just a couple of days ago, there was the justices voted 5-4 against a class action suit. When that, and now that one's coming up with Walmart, of course. And so it seems to me people have to overthrow the justice system in a sense, too, in order to get justice. Thank you.
So in terms of the problem with the federal courts, and I'm glad to see that problem come up time and again now, I think it's just important for us to recognize, maybe most of us do recognize, it sounds like, that we were in a period in American history that was exceptional in terms of the federal courts from sort of the end of the Roosevelt administration till roughly 1990. And that was the exception to prove the rule in terms of the federal courts, that throughout American history, especially in the first and into the second century, the federal courts were not on the side of the working person. If you look at Wisconsin's own history in terms of our fights over states' rights, our ability to regulate the railroads, we said the 10th Amendment gave us some powers against the railroad companies, and the Supreme Court begged to differ. If you look at our position on slavery and our attempt to recognize that our state constitution has as much validity as the constitution of the state of South Carolina did in its time and its within its boundaries, within its jurisdiction. There are many examples, certainly, from U.S. legal history that you can point to that I think give evidence to the idea that the court system is an inherently not only conservative but a reactionary institution. And I think that it was only played some progressive roles during the latter half of the 20th century because we were in the midst of the Cold War, and it was deemed to be in the national interest to have certain guarantees that would protect the United States against criticisms that we were coming under in this contest with the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union had many terrible flaws, certainly. But I would rather, frankly, I think the contest between the United States and the Soviet Union was a better one for social justice in the United States than the contest between the United States and China today. And so that's just my perspective on the question of federal courts. I personally don't invest in legal strategies aimed at climbing up through the courts. For me, the last such creative strategy that I was invested in was the New Party strategy of building the legal case for fusion under the First Amendment. That got shot down in, I don't know, 98, Timmins' decision. So I don't see that as having much of an opening.
Rose Stein from the Middleton Action Team. In the last couple of days, I've heard allegations that the students at the UW voted twice, here in UW and then in their home area too. And then I went to the voter ID hearing and heard the students speaking and the inane questions that were asked by some of the people on the panel, which was very infuriating to me. And I wonder if there's any chance of having like a class action suit against these allegations, because even though they are never proven to be false, that it's out there all the time. These students voted twice, and that's why we need the ID bill, and that's what happened in 2008, et cetera, et cetera. And so is there some way, you know, then people begin to believe it. And so is there some way to fight back against these kind of things?
I don't know what to say about the voter fraud allegations, Rose. I do know that a friend of mine recently revealed that a Republican operative committed voter fraud this past fall. He has evidence of it. He's shows her bragging about voting in a district that she was not living in, and on Alaska. She was working on a campaign, but the evidence was that she was living here in Madison, right? So to my knowledge, there have been no examples of students being convicted of voter fraud in the state of Wisconsin, but yet that message keeps on spreading. So that's a discussion. I don't want to take more time on it, just to say I want to have that discussion with people because I don't have an answer for that.
Roger Williams, retired UW professor, still very active in teaching and consulting and lots of volunteer activities. Mm-hmm. Americans for Prosperity and AM radio commentators have become masters at getting ordinary citizens to vote against their best interests. And I forget the name of the book about Kansas, but...
What's the Matter with Kansas?
What's the Matter with Kansas, yeah. And that book framed it very well, how ordinary citizens essentially vote against their own best interests, and how to deal with that issue of the AM commentators and the Americans for Prosperity, which have become so powerful at this point in time. And the Tea Party would be yet a third piece of this. And then I guess I would come at another question, how to really bring about a movement, because progressives are notorious for getting lots and lots of factions going. They're not united. Liberals and progressives tend to be very factionated, and how to bring them all together and speak with one voice would be a key issue.
In terms of the question about Americans for Prosperity and getting people to to vote against their own best interests, I think that frankly the answer to that is to go out there and do more organizing. My experience has been that when you actually reach out and you talk to people who otherwise are only getting their information from certain sources, that a very large number of those people are not committed ideologues, right? They have a very limited sort of commitment to that agenda, and that it is possible to build coalitions that that not only reach across sort of our existing borders in terms of our movement, but that actually bring people into the progressive movement. So. Let me say that more clearly. For many years, I was a canvas director in Wisconsin, and that basically for the organization that's now Clean Wisconsin, and went door to door in pretty much every small town in southern Wisconsin, even towns of 400 or 500. And my experience was that in taking on the Exxon Minerals Corporation, it was possible to move literally tens of thousands of people. From a position of simply buying the line that project was about jobs to understanding that it was really about theft of natural resources, right? So I just think that it's a simplistic answer, but I think it's a true answer. There is too much of singing to the choir, and that when we go beyond the choir and we sing to other people, it has a positive impact. I don't think that's the whole answer, but I do think it can work. It does work. How do we bring about a movement that brings together all the factions and fractions, as you put it? That's essentially what I've been working on doing with this democracy movement. I think that by centralizing democracy, that you create a common vehicle for people with very diverse sets of interests to come together and work together and take risks together to develop a basis for trust. Because when a democratic reform, that empowers all kinds of people. Right? It doesn't just empower one set of constituencies. So if, for example, you have a elected board of regents, or if you have the ability to protect same-day voter registration and then to expand voting rights in Wisconsin, there are many, many constituencies that benefit from that. And those constituencies with their single interests can come together and work together. So I think that pro-democracy campaigns are naturally builders of lasting coalitions. I also think campaigns for constitutional amendments provide a very important positive role in terms of providing a long-term vehicle for democratic reform that, again, brings together very diverse sets of constituencies. So if you look at the constitutional amendment process as being a movement-building process, I think it has a lot of good things to say for it.
Mitzi Duxbury, also retired professor. and a member of the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, and the Southwest Move to Amend. I hear a lot of very good suggestions here, but not much about how to deal with the opposition. Over Easter, I was in North Dakota, and there's a very aggressive, creative attorney out there that started a website that was most enlightening to me, and I'll give it to you in a minute. But he identified, and this relates to Tea Partiers, corporate control of our media, he identified a group in this small town of 40 people, and he wanted to know more about them. But they only had a post office box. So he challenged them, that's illegal, so then they got a physical address, which happened to be UPS. Then he tracks them farther, and he says these groups are active in 40 states now. He found out they're funded by the Koch brothers through very circuitous routes. He identified some woman that's actively involved in another one of these organizations, and she said she had no relation to the Koch brothers, but he trailed the money that goes from this organization to this organization to this organization to this woman, who's the head of one of these other groups coming from the Koch brothers. And when he said this is in 40 states, I thought, you know, we've got to do a lot more to move this agenda. What they have done, I couldn't figure out why the Tea Party was so effective. I thought, that's stupid. But yet, look what happened. And I think it relates to rumor theory. No matter how false it is, if you repeat it often enough, people will believe it. And I think that documented by this birther crap, when even the president has to go to the legal authorities to release the full legal thing. So I think we need to look at ways to develop these movements from the bottom up, through small groups, better education, like this magnificent speech you just gave us, Ben. I think that, wish it was on a disc that I could send out to a lot of people. And I think encouragingly we are making some little inroads outside of university circles. We can't have a movement succeed that's university circles and some old progressives. I mean, let's get real. Okay. We've got to have it from the bottom up and learn how to get messages out, correct messages and activity in small communities, locally based. Could I just give the website for this? It's called sure. The North Decoder. It's great, a great
website. Thank you.
I have just a couple of responses to that. I'm sure others have more as well. But you know, there is a reason why the organization that I founded in 2004 is called Liberty Tree. There's a number of reasons for that. One of which is that, frankly, as somebody whose family comes from Boston, I grew up in Madison, but my family's from Boston, and who grew up around all those patriotic sites, and whose family always flies the American flag on July 4th, and who are predominantly very progressive people, I have always understood that everything that is great about America is a product of the progressive movement. And there are many things, having traveled quietly and having grown up part of my life overseas, about the United States of America that are far better than many other places in the world. There are many things that are terrible about our society, but there are many things that are wonderful about our society in relation to other societies. And so I think that the way that we deal with the Tea Party is that we get out there and we reclaim our history. We deny them the ability to claim our history. I mean, I've even seen people on the right try to claim the history of abolition as a basis for their, you know, this drove me nuts. Michelle Bachmann, right, was out there, talking about how, you know, the left hates America and how there was a failure, that the left did not recognize that, in fact, you know, even at the time of the Constitution, there were, you know, many people who were against slavery, and slavery was abolished in the North, and so on. And you know what drove me nuts about that? was that she was right. And I saw Chris Matthews taking her to task about how the founders were all slave owners and how, you know, they all, you know, tried to enshrine, you know, slavery into the Constitution, and he was wrong. And for the left, you know, we do need to recognize that we have had a contested history since the get-go, and that even in the 1770s there were abolitionists and women's rights advocates, and that women had the right to vote in New Jersey, and that slavery was abolished in various states immediately during the Revolutionary War by vote, by legislative vote, not just by court order, right? And that is our history. So we deal with that capture of the American narrative by recapturing our narrative, and that Liberty Tree is a part of that, is recognizing our roots in American history. And then finally, we deal with the opposition by going after them directly. You know, they're doing that to us. You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Bradley Foundation, the Koch brothers, these institutions are actively going out to undermine, to co-opt where they can, but to undermine where they can't, people's movements. You've seen that with the attack on student organizing around the country, with the Southworth strategy that was pursued in the 1990s, where there was a legal challenge that was brought to the ability of students to collect student fees and to use those for political advocacy. That challenge effectively was somewhat successful in terms of the decision that came down from the Supreme Court. Technically, we won, but effectively, they had a chilling effect on the ability of students to collect student fees and to use those. They've been going after unions, as we well know, through attacks not only on the political speech of unions, and I'm not talking about Citizens United, but I'm talking about about the attack on unions in engaging in political speech on behalf of their members, but also the attack on unions in terms of collective bargaining rights, fair share dues collection, and so on. So they've been doing that to us. We need to do the same thing to them. I will just end with this to say that sometimes that can be dangerous to go after them. I recently found out via Think Progress that the Chamber of Commerce was aware that I and others I was working with nationally were discussing a national campaign against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they hired a defense contractor to spy on us. And so this was revealed by Anonymous. If you're familiar with Anonymous, it's, you know, they're hacktivists, right? So they hacked this public relations firm's accounts, and out of the 70,000 emails that came out of there, one of the documents that was revealed was a PowerPoint presentation in which they're sort of graphing their relationships, you know, see the connections, as David Horowitz likes to say, and move to amend, and myself personally are sort of in there in this set of discussions that we were actually having about the role of the Chamber of Commerce in politics, and so on. So I guess the fact that they were taking it seriously is a positive sign, right?
Sheila Reeves, UW-Madison, and how heavily invested are you with social media? We talk about the potential age gap or the fact that the left is not organized, but you can be very organized. Arab Spring kind of proved that. You can have an organization electronically, even though I don't Facebook and Twitter, but I would imagine that the national convention that's coming here and hopefully Wisconsin Wave is advanced in social media skills.
Absolutely, and I would urge you to begin to waste your time with Facebook and Twitter too, because it has a way of taking over your life, but it also is very useful for the reasons that you stated. So the Wisconsin Wave does have a Facebook group. We have about 700 people on it, and they communicate with one another through Facebook. I certainly use Facebook a lot. I'm just able, it is useful. We have actually worked to develop our own social media at Liberty Tree. So we have a project that's ongoing that's called Democracy Square, and it's at democracysquare.org. And what we do is we manage, we have 11 different websites that operate off of the same platform that we developed. And what it allows us to do is that we can post information in one place, and it will also appear on another website at the same time. And this is something that was custom. So what it allows us to do really is to build a sense of the broader movement within each different area. So something will appear on the Democratizing Education website under full funding for public higher education, but it might also appear on the local democracy website under funding for public services because it's an article or an analysis that looks at declining financing for the public sector, right? So Move to Amend is a Democracy Square website. The Wisconsin Wave is. Those other websites I mentioned are. It's not fully operational yet. I mean, those sites are very operational. But what we hope to do is to turn it into a full online community. We have roughly 120,000 people on our list now between these various efforts, and everybody will get their own account, and they'll be able to, you know, exchange information and vote on things and do other things like that. So,
hi, I'm Doug Bradley, Madison Institute board member. Ben, this is more in the form of an observation, but I think there's a question implied. Your quote before, Vince Lombardi, not only are we not playing offense, I think we're playing bad defense. For example, if collective bargaining does not go through, they, in a sense, have won anyway because people are leaving state employ at record numbers. They are diminishing the ranks of teachers in higher education and at K-12. My wife's office, for example, she's a legislative service agency. They are losing hundreds of years of institutional history. So in a sense, they're going to shrink state. They won't refill those positions. So in a sense, they are going to win at least part of that battle. The University of Wisconsin. Now that it seems that the co-chairs of joint finance are not interested in the public authority at this point. They're talking about studying it. The university will, as a result, will have perhaps no flexibility, any of the campuses, and a $250 million cut, half of it directed at UW-Madison. So they will indeed have their economic crisis that they want. So I'm concerned about this because it seems even when we move to stop something, and that's great work, that there's still too many gains on the other side.
No, I absolutely agree with that observation. I oftentimes say to people that part of the reason why I started to devote myself to building a democracy movement as opposed to any of the existing movements that I and many of us have been a part of was that we won that fight against Exxon in the 1990s. It was a huge fight, but it became evident to me that even in winning this incredible struggle, they had moved ahead, and by they, I mean the corporate sector or that section of the corporate sector had moved ahead on other fronts. And that's why we need to have this broader pushback. They clearly have a best defense is a good offense strategy. Scott Walker said as much to David Koch, i.e., really Ian Murphy, who made that call. He said, look, even if we don't win on this thing, the unions have already conceded. That was, frankly, a horrible mistake on the part of some labor leaders. To be clear, many labor leaders in Wisconsin did not go along with those concessions. They were sort of imposed on them by others, but I think it was a bad mistake. And on the other hand, Walker knows exactly what he's doing. I think you're exactly right. That's the reason why I think that in the coming weeks and months, our message around the state budget should be, it's time for a do-over. We have to reboot the budget. Right? That's sort of the message I'm starting to get out there. We need to reboot the budget. This budget process is fundamentally flawed. The agenda was set by corporate lobbyists. It has set up an incredibly divisive moment in Wisconsin history. There are so many aspects of this budget that would torment so many people in the state that the process has to be started over through a public hearing process, and that's my pushback to them.
Some of these organizations are trying to do an alternative budget. They haven't gotten down to the detail that they need, but they've been getting there by grouping different things, and I hope that they're going to have it out in the next couple of weeks. Okay, Hathaway.
I'm on the internet a lot, but I'm just getting on Facebook a little bit more. But how about moveon.com? I'd like to go out of here with a little bit more sense of order about what on earth where we should jump in and where the best place. Liberty Tree, I don't know LibertyTree.com, is that what it is?
LibertyTreeFDR.org, and there's a long story to that. But if you Google Liberty Tree,
yeah, first which I will do.
Yep, there you go.
But you see what I mean? We're going with now more organizations being brought to our attention and not going out with a sense of, so Huffington Post, you know, big blogs, but I'd like a little bit more of a sense of order about it.
Of order. It is a very disordered movement. And actually, I think we do need more organizations, not less, to be frank. And the reason for that is that there is a moment in which an organization moves beyond the capacity of its members to effectively participate. And when that happens, that's when you actually start to lose some of the capacity of a group or organization that it had before. So I'm actually arguing for more confusion and complexity in some ways. I will say that MoveOn is a group that does many good things. They have a very different kind of mission and way of operating than we do, and that they work to bring together, provide a very big tent nationally, and they mobilize people at particular moments in time to put pressure in particular places, right? But they're not an organizing vehicle. They've started to shift a little bit in that way through having councils and so on, but they're not really building, I think they have a very distinct kind of strategy. Our strategy is to develop legal doctrines, to develop reforms that people can advance in our communities, right, at the ground level, and push forward, right? And that involves, a lot of grassroots organizing. Right. So we have sometimes, I'll be frank, sometimes I've had a very positive relationship with MoveOn folks. Sometimes it hasn't been so positive. It depends. There's different people at MoveOn. There's some good folks from the Madison area, actually, who are involved nationally. Sometimes they're criticized for sort of swooping in on an issue, right, sucking up a lot of money, and then moving on to the next one. And I've made that criticism myself. John Stalbert here in town from the Center for Media and Democracy has had some tangles with folks there too. So it's not all, I want to claim, the rule is supposed to be that you're always supposed to claim that everything's easy and simple. It's not, there is friction, there are difficulties, but there's also coexistence and I can't help you with the simplicity and the order. I don't think we're going to get that. Sorry.
Okay.
Tom Vanderbest, the Middleton Action Team and retired principal at Middleton High School. And my big concern is the demonizing of teachers and teaching staff at K-12, but also at the university levels. And I'm also concerned now on how the boards of education are responding. And we in Middleton had a very excellent relationship with our board for years, and now the present contract that they came up with initially was almost a throwback to what Walker is talking about. They took out Just Cause and a lot of other things. I'd like your comments on that and where we can go to support our teachers.
And I'll just respond briefly. I think I can come up with shorter responses, so I'll continue to do that as long as that works. So I think, first of all, the reason why they have worked so hard, and by they, I mean in this case Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and other institutions in Wisconsin have worked so hard to demonize teachers is because teachers are so loved and popular. Now they're going after firefighters too, right? Well, they're doing that because they have a problem. Teachers and firefighters and nurses are way more popular than corporate executives are. And they're still way more popular, even after generations of demonizing of teachers. I mean, my mom was a teacher at West, some of you know, for many years. And I remember her complaining about the demonization of teachers and seeing it when I was a kid. Teachers are just as popular today as they ever were. I think that what that shows is that a lot of times you see attacks that happen on us that are designed to get people to keep their heads down, right? But they don't actually reflect any kind of popular sentiment, right? And what it does is it allows those who are in positions of authority, like a school board or a chancellor, to implement policies and to point to, for example, the demonization of teachers as an excuse or as a rationale, even if that rationale doesn't have a basis in fact, right? Another example I would give is the way in which there's always the claim that the public doesn't support, it's not willing to pay for education, right? I don't think that actually bears out in fact, right? It's not actually true when you do public opinion surveys in the state of Wisconsin that people are not willing to support public higher education. But what that sort of line allows WMC to do is to go into the legislature and get their legislation through and point to that argument, to that perception as a cover. In terms of what you're dealing with in Middleton right now, I've heard inklings about it, but I guess what I would say is, I know you did a rally a couple weeks ago, or maybe late in February, February 26th, or sometime around then, but I think that to the extent that we're able to help you to mobilize people to support teachers in Milton, I mean, we should be bringing people out and put pressure on the school board and on the Board of Education there and to make them feel some heat around this. And I know you're doing that. So I guess my question is, how can the rest of us help you to do that? Because it concerns me, too.
Ben, I have another thing I bring up quite often because it still bothers me greatly. I have very lovely relatives on Linda's side and my side who are right-wing, born-again fundamentalists. I guarantee you every one of them would support this bill. They come out, whether they live in New York State, in Colorado, Pennsylvania, every place they are, they have exactly the same agenda, right-wing churches. Yet it's un-American to attack a religious belief. These churches provide a tremendous sense of community. If you attend them, they are real community. We don't supply that, but they also are the biggest political party we have. How do we confront the reality, appreciate their sense of community, and make them aware that they are either a political party and should be treated as such, or they have to be free and not proselytize?
Gene, pass your microphone down to Kai.
Kai Fouché, a resident here of Capitol Lakes. I would like to follow up a bit on your bringing in the fundamentalist Christians and point out that both Paul Ryan and Walker have publicly said that their ideology was formed by their reading Ayn Rand in their youth. Now, Ayn Rand, who has formed the ideological basis for Leo Strauss that formulated the neocon philosophy, and Milton Friedman, who formulated the economic ideology, was a rabid atheist in addition to be devoid of any shred of empathy. And this is a philosophy that the religious conservatives embrace, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody heard what Gene said, right? And then I think, you know, Kai was raising the influence of Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. There's now the first installment of an Atlas Shrugged film, which I don't plan to see, that is now out in the theaters. I've heard some of my students talking about that. And there is a certain cognitive dissonance that exists, I think, for a lot of young people in particular who are trying to sort of evaluate what they think, and they, on one hand, spouting Marxist ideology, and we'll be talking about Atlas Shrugged as if the two can coexist in the same brain for long. But I think that I don't have all the answers. I have a lot of ideas, but I do think that you're absolutely right, Gene, that we need to have a counterculture, not a counterculture which is a countercultural to everything American, and not a total rejection, not a total separation from the rest of society, but a counterculture that is counter to that counterculture that is developed within the churches, within some churches, within, you know, the extreme right. And, you know, I think, frankly, your comment, Kai, sort of raises some of the possibility for that for me, which is that we need to have a very vibrant cultural agenda that is deeply rooted in American history, that It allows people to feel that they are part of a tradition of social change that has gone on for a millennia, really, when you get down to it, but certainly for several hundred years on this continent at least, and that is really celebratory of that tradition. So, for example, something I have wanted to do for a number of years is to reclaim the 4th of July here in Madison. I am very frustrated that we have the, you know, the very, I wouldn't even call it sanitized, but the emptied, the gutted 4th of July celebrations that happen at Warner Park every year. I think that, you know, maybe this is something the Madison Institute would be interested in taking on, to set up a 4th of July commission in the city of Madison. That's certainly something I want to work on. And to organize, you know, events that actually help people to recognize the traditions that we come from. So I just think that, I think that Madison does a pretty good job of this compared to a lot of other places. To be real, I mean, I think, you know, Norm Stockwell, WRT, the whole community of folks who organize the cultural affairs and the programming that help people to recognize people's history have had an impact. It had an impact on me growing up. It's had an impact on many other people in the Madison area, and I think we need more of that around the state of Wisconsin and around the country. And I'll just say this, it drives Sarah nuts. I ask people all the time when I meet them when they're younger, where are you from? You know, where are you from? What high school did you go to in Wisconsin? And I, you know, immediately start putting them into boxes. And it is the Madison kids, frankly, who are often in Middleton, too, if you look at the UW-Madison and MATC right now, who are usually the first out of the box. And it's because, again, they come from a place in which they understand the traditions that they've inherited, they understand where they're coming from, they have a sense of legitimacy, they have a spirit, and that's really what we have to foster as a counter-movement nationally to that kind of spirit that the fundamentalists have.
Well, we'll put his point on our agenda
for
July 4th.
Hi, Fred Wade, a member of the Madison Institute Board and a Madison attorney. I just wanted to underline, Ben, the point you talked about the austerity situation we're in, which is creating a range of choices that are unpleasant. I call it choosing to be broke. You know, we're here in this situation because we have chosen to be broke by keeping taxes down, revenues down, starving government, and it creates a set of false choices. I think you made a good point when you pointed out what we could do if we ended the Afghanistan-Iraq wars now. I mean, that's part of the equation. I mean, if we had those revenues, we could do a lot of things. We wouldn't be faced with some of the choices that we're faced with in terms of having this debate about do we need to reform entitlement programs, quote unquote, meaning under Paul Ryan's plan, end it for anyone under 55. And it occurred to me also during the health care debate, the Republicans were complaining that we couldn't afford a health care reform because we cost $1 trillion over 10 years, the cost of the Iraq War. But it was never put out in terms of, well, you have a choice. We could stop having Iraq wars and have health care reform, or we could have this debate about whether we can afford it if we're going to continue to have the war. So just to give you an opportunity to kind of underline that point that you made earlier.
Yeah, and actually it does give me a springboard, and thank you, Fred, and I really respect your work, and we had a fun time on the campaign trail together, and thank you for running, and I hope that you'll consider doing that again, because there's a need for progressive representation in the 77th District. I'll just say that the argument, we have the arguments down, right? We have the analysis down, which is not always the case, right? We're not always good at sort of pulling the curtain back and saying, no, this is a choice that has been made for us. I think we do need to recognize that it's not us, it's not we the people that have made these decisions, right? These are, you know, it is an imposed crisis, and that I actually do have great faith in the American people, even folks in Arizona and Alabama and Walworth County, to make the right decisions given the opportunity, but we're not given the opportunity most of the time. And that statement is even true within sort of the progressive movement. I mean, one thing that's incredibly frustrating to me is that, you know, as somebody who is not a member of the Democratic Party, I oftentimes find myself in a position where what the leadership of the Democratic Party does will have a very major impact on the possibilities for organizing that I want to do. And for those of you who are progressive Democrats, you're in the same boat, right? You don't get to decide what comes out of Obama's mouth or what comes out of Nancy Pelosi's mouth or what decisions they make. And we're in this position where we are essentially subject to institutions far beyond our control. So that's a lasting problem, I think, and it's a reason why we have this continuing debate about electoral strategy. You know, do we build an independent political party? Do we build some sort of a nonpartisan alliance? Do we try to reform the Democratic Party from within, or, you know, God forbid, the Republican Party, as they tried, you know, a century ago to take it back? And I think that regardless of where you end up on that question in terms of electoral strategy, the present reality remains that we need an independent voice that is strong enough nationally so that we can meaningfully articulate the arguments that we know so well and that just don't get heard. I don't think that you can articulate those messages and arguments in a meaningful way so that they can be heard unless you show some independence from the political, from the power structure nationally, from the National Democratic Party, from elections themselves, right? That is really what we have to do. I think that's why we've been so successful here in Wisconsin in the last couple weeks and months, is that you've had a very, one thing that's been positive is that we've had a very broad progressive movement in which there were not interruptions in communications. In other words, you'll have progressive Democrats working very effectively with socialists and anarchists and young people who don't have their politics fully sorted out yet and so on, right? And you'll have, and that was good, right? But at the same time, the reality was that those progressive Democrats who were having to deal with some of their less progressive cousins in the legislature recognized the value of the occupation of the Capitol and the street action and the talk of the general strike. So a Mark Pocan or a John Urbanbach, you know, or a Kelda Royce saw the need for movement outside of the Democratic Party, and they embraced that. So let's recognize that that was a positive lesson from what we've been through in the last couple months.
Paul Beckett, a member of the Madison Institute Board, retired faculty member.
I have a short point, and I think it's a positive one. I wanted to start out by saying that I think we should be inspired by the Tea Party. They represent really a pretty small minority in terms of the people that come out and are active. And yet the Republican Party is terrified of them. They've had an enormous impact on our society. We found in February and March this year that when a much larger representative share of the Wisconsin population came out on the street, we had an enormous impact. What I'm saying, and this ties into what you've been saying all along, is that if the population becomes active, I think a lot of the advantages that you ran through at the beginning in terms of corporate power just absolutely get swept away.
Charles Hopoff, also a member of the TMI board. One of the things that I think was mentioned also by some of the other people who spoke was the importance of relationships. And those really are key, I think, in terms of moving forward. And one of the things I would like to do is extend an invitation as well. This locally, in Oregon, we have an Oregon Area Progressives, which had our first open mic last month with Mark Miller, who came. And we have one planned for May the 5th with John Nichols, who's going to be coming, and one for June the 2nd with Kathleen Beinhout. But it's an opportunity also for people, ordinary people, who want to be able to have their voices heard, to have the mic, to be able to speak out. Increasingly, the focus needs to be looking at ways in which we can bring people together and recreate and build a sense of community that can persist and can carry on and nurture and support both the economic institutions, but also develop the relationships and the social support networks that are so critical in a very difficult time.
So what you're doing in Oregon, or Oregon, I should say, I did live in Oregon for a little while, so I had to relearn how to say Oregon when I moved back to Madison. What you're doing in Oregon, what you folks are doing in Middleton, what people are doing in communities around the state of Wisconsin is really the work, is the people's work, right? It's not God's work, it's the people's work. Maybe if you are like me and you look to the history of the Sons of Liberty and the original Tea Party, you'll recognize that, as they said, the voice of the people is the voice of God, right? So it's the people's work that you're doing. It's really amazing work. I would urge you to make use of me. I know I don't always respond as quickly as I should. It's been overwhelming, as it has been for many people in the last couple of weeks and months. But I may be able to help you to build those relationships even broader. The folks, I'm thinking, you know, about the location of Oregon and about this home reoccupation that's happening on Hammersley Road. And I think it would probably be very positive to invite folks from Freedom Inc. and from Take Back the Land to come down to sort of help to reach beyond sort of our normal circles. I've worked on Sly in the Morning, in terms of getting him to have some of those folks on. He had criticized their action that they took last year when they had the first home reoccupation. He's more open to it now. He sees that this crisis is ongoing. So I just want to say thank you for organizing Oregon Progressives and the Middleton Action Team and the Madison Institute, certainly. And I honor your work and contributions. I look forward to working with you guys in the coming weeks and months. And also, if you're interested in getting involved in the Democracy Convention organizing, we have a host committee that will be meeting in the coming weeks. Having a first meeting, and would love to have your participation and support.
Ben, we have one more person who wants to get a question in or a comment.
Hello, Ben. My name is Natalie Mara. I'm a visitor of my dear friend Fred Wade and his wife Marilyn Townsend for the past 30 years, so Madison is very close to my heart. I have a question, and it comes out of something that I heard on the radio, but I'd like your answer to, would you, and if you do, defined what is going on in our country as class warfare?
Yeah, it's absolutely class warfare. There's no question. And it's amazing to me that it's taken so many of us, and I think this is more true, again, in this case of my generation, than of people who've been around the block a little bit more. It's taken so many of us to recognize that what is happening right now with the enthronement of corporations in our politics really is an attempt to institute class rule. It's an attempt to drive the corporate class into the Constitution to legitimize the lack of democracy that we have in this country. It's when you look at the shift of wealth in the last generation from working people and from working middle class people and from the poor to the very wealthy, how could you call it anything other than class warfare?
The preceding program featured Ben Mansky, director of Liberty Tree Foundation. The web address for Wisconsin Wave is www.wisconsinwave.org. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute or members of its board of directors.